Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Today on Connecting Faith, I'm excited to spend some time talking with John Dixon. John is a senior research fellow of the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. He's co-director of the Center for Public Christianity, a senior minister of St. Andrews, Roseville. He's authored more than a dozen books and several historical documentaries for Australian television, does a great deal of speaking in corporations, universities, churches, and conferences. And I had an opportunity to hear John a couple of years ago at the Leadership Summit, and I, along with many others, were challenged by what he had to say based on a book that he wrote a couple of years ago called Humilitas, A Lost Key to Life, Love, and Leadership. And this is all about humility, and I had to laugh as he tells the beginning of the book what qualifies him to write on the subject of humility. A friend of his suggested that he could pursue this as a historian because he had enough objective distance from the subject. So with that, John, welcome to Connecting Faith. Thank you for taking some time today.
Great to be here. Yes, you need friends like that to tell you you have objective distance from humility to keep you humble.
In fact, we'll circle back to that maybe after a while about what does it take to help us maybe attain more humility, and maybe it is just that kind of friendship. But let's start with the definition first. And I thought one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you here and early on in the new year is to just many of us, I think, are saying, you know, we want to we set our resolutions or goals, say, I want to live differently, I want to act differently, and this seems like one of the key areas that we can address because it affects so many other aspects of life. So let's talk with definitions first. What do we mean when we say humility?
Well, it's important to give it a definition because so often people hear the word humility and they either think it's being a doormat for others, or they think it's not trying to achieve too much, or some people associate it even with humiliation, which of course comes from the same Latin word, humilitas. But the way humility is used, certainly in the Christian texts, and these are the texts that influenced our Western notion of humility, see humility not as having low self-esteem or anything like that, but redirecting all of your powers, whatever those powers be, for the good of others. So the root idea of humility is lowliness. The word, both in Greek and in Latin, means low, but in normal Greek and Roman usage, it meant to be crushed down low. But the Christians kind of subverted that and said, no, it's to choose to lower yourself for the sake of another person. And the key idea, I think, is it's a kind of noble choice to put others first, to take what you have, whether it's money or intellect or physical prowess, and redirect it for the service of others. That's the key thought here.
It's an interesting word, too, just to suggest that it's a noble choice, because it does take it's not something that just sort of happens randomly, is it?
No, certainly not in my life. Don't know about yours, Hill. No, I don't. I don't often sort of randomly break into acts of humility. It really is a decision to think all these gifts and skills and opportunities and powers that I have in my possession are really there not for me. They're actually there for the good of others. And so choosing to lower yourself in that sense is what humility is about. And of course it's noble, because the humble person knows that they have these gifts. It's not denying that you have these gifts and powers and opportunities, but you recognize them and, as I say, nobly decide that they're for the good of others. So you redirect them for the sake of another person.
I was thinking how would you distinguish it from maybe other virtues? Or are there, I guess one of the things I was thinking about was meekness, you know, that we think about that. Is there a distinction between meekness and humility?
There is. I mean, they're two different words in both ancient Latin and in ancient Greek. And interestingly, the Greeks and Romans did enjoy the notion of meekness or gentleness or modestia, because what this basically meant is the partial moderation of power, almost like the opposite of gloating. See, ancient people despised hubris, that is the sort of the extreme arrogance of a great person. And modestia, or meekness, is the moderation of that so that it wasn't vile and despicable. But it's quite a different thing from humility, because humility actually says these things aren't just to be slightly modified so as not to be ugly. They're actually there to be used for the sake of another. And in this way, the word humility was not used by ancient Greeks or Romans, because they thought to decide to lower yourself for the sake of another was itself a sort of breaking of the natural law. Greek and Roman ethics had this very strong sense that the natural laws had set people in their particular station, the high and the low, the rich, the poor, and that to subvert that through a high person treating a low person as if a high person was to actually mess with reality. So humility was actually regarded as a weakness in Greek and Roman society, certainly not a virtue.
Which obviously influenced much of the world then, and I assume it probably does today as well.
Yes, I mean, people often say that our Western culture is an almost schizophrenic accounting for our Greek and Roman heritage on the one side and our Judeo-Christian heritage on the other. And you can see that in this topic of humility. On the one hand, we are very influenced by Greece and Rome in that many Westerners think about their own honor, their own glory. They hate to be put to shame. They hate to lower their status. Well, that's all very Greek and Roman. In fact, it's very human. But at the same time, I think our culture in the West has been massively influenced by the particularly Christian idea of humility, because most people love it when a hugely powerful person is other person-centered, when a hugely person with huge high status treats someone of supposedly low status as honorable. Ancients thought that messed with reality. We love it. So we are this kind of, we are a blend of all these cultures.
I know in the book, and it's just a short little book, but it's just powerful in its insights. And I know you do spend some time talking about how Jesus really kind of turned the tables on this philosophy of the day. Why don't we, as long as we're kind of talking about that, let's just expand on that a little bit. What was Jesus, in particularly with Jesus' crucifixion, right?
I mean, obviously, Jesus taught some humble things. Whoever wants to be great among you must be slave of all. That's pretty outrageous. That is the overturning of the ancient idea of honor and shame, of power and weakness. But that probably wasn't the key factor in bedding humility down in Western culture. The key factor seems to be the crucifixion of Jesus. Because in the crucifixion, we have the supposedly greatest man on the most shameful, powerless part of the Roman world. A crucifixion was regarded as the greatest of all shames in the ancient world. Many people ended up crucified for various crimes, usually extreme ones. and it was regarded as the most shameful way to die. So, of course, you can see how this troubled the early Christians, because if their great master was on a cross, it either meant he wasn't as great as we thought, or it means greatness has to be redefined to somehow include the idea of deliberately lowering yourself, even shaming yourself, for the sake of another. And obviously that's the path the early Christians took. They reasoned that Jesus was God in the flesh, and he chose to go to the cross, and that was a noble choice to take all of his power and use it for the sake of others. We can see this shift in Philippians chapter 2, a beautiful passage in the New Testament, where Paul, in fact, talks about Jesus in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but he emptied himself and took on our humanity. And then Paul says he humbled himself, using this word that normally in Greek meant to be crushed. Paul uses it here to mean Jesus chose to humble himself and become obedient to death, even death on a cross. And as soon as Paul says that, you know what he's thinking is the crucifixion of Jesus turns greatness on its head. Now greatness must include the noble choice to lower yourself, to redirect your power for the sake of others, just like Jesus.
In this new year, we want to see our lives reflect more like Christ. What does that look like? Well, it involves understanding more about humility, and we're talking about that today with the speaker and historian John Dixon, and talking about his book Humilitas, A Lost Key to Life, Love, and Leadership. And we'll talk more with John in just a moment here on Connecting Faith.
Encouragement for an active walk of faith. Podcast audio of today's programs on Faith Radio in case you missed the show. The very latest on conferences and events in your area. It's all in one place and delivered right to your inbox from Faith Radio when you subscribe by email to myfaithradio.com. Head to myfaithradio.com and enter your email address in the subscribe box right at the top of the page, helping you connect faith to life every day at myfaithradio.com.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitmer, General Manager of Faith Radio. You and I both know that living for Jesus is a lifelong journey, and we're committed to helping you connect faith to life with access when you need it. And to help you keep your faith strong throughout the day, we'd like to send you a Live by Faith wristband. It's free. Wear it each day as a reminder that you're on a journey of faith. If you would like your free wristband, visit myfaithradio.com to request yours. We'll get it out to you as soon as possible.
You're listening to Connecting Faith, and today we're connecting across the pond with the speaker and historian John Dixon, who's a senior research fellow at the Department of Ancient History at the Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, where we wish that John would share just a little bit of their extra warmth there, where they've had it hot in Australia, and here in the upper Midwest we're shivering a bit. But we're learning about an important topic, humility. And John, I know one of the things you address in the book, make the statement about thoughtful people recognize what they don't know. And is that really kind of all it is on the road to humility? Does it start there?
Well, it certainly starts there. I think it was C.S. Lewis said something like the first step toward humility is to realize that you're not humble, and I think that is a great first step to realize our own selfishness, our own limitations, and so on. But it is very common, isn't it, for particularly high achievers to think that their high achievement gives them license to pontificate on all sorts of subjects, even outside their realm of expertise. So you'll sometimes find some great executive in a business who is perhaps brilliant at telecommunications, but because he or she is used to people listening to them all day long and doing whatever they say, they come home and still speak with the kind of air of authority and importance that they have at the office place. And obviously that is going to break down relationships. It really isn't. It is one way to avoid humility.
You know, we hear that saying, it's not about thinking less of ourselves, it's just thinking of ourselves less. And what do you think, what does that mean maybe practically?
Well, I think it means you don't have to be shy about the talents and opportunities and powers that you have. I mean, if someone has a brilliantly high IQ, then, you know, they can't go around pretending that they're dumb. Mm-hmm. There's no point, you know, hiding one's intelligence. But if one decides to use that intelligence for the sake of others instead of just for their own gain, you know, outwitting people, making more money and so on, then that's humility. Humility is the decision to take what's, you know, the powers that you have and use it for the sake of others. So it's not about thinking less of yourself. It's not about a great sports person thinking they're actually not a great sports person, a great military leader thinking they're not actually a great military leader and so on. It's about thinking, yeah, I've got these gifts and these opportunities, and I'm going to use them for the sake of others. That's humility.
Just thinking about that old country song, "Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way," right?
So,
but I guess some people, I mean, do have, if you have achieved mastery at some level, then that maybe makes it even more difficult.
I'm sure it does, but obviously, I mean, at a purely logical level, it shouldn't, because when you have mastered one area, that should tell you how much there is to know, how much there is to master in all of the areas that you're not an expert. So I often say that the true expert ought to be the most humble person amongst us, because they know how much there is to know about stuff. I mean, I know quite a lot about the ancient world, and particularly the eastern part of the Roman world in the first century. But the fact that I know quite a lot about that should remind me that there are people who know that much about 20th century history or 17th century American history or mathematics or music. And so my expert knowledge in one area should be a reason for me to be humble in every other area.
John, I was interested in, you think about mastery, yet we're in the, at least in the States, have been inundated with the self-esteem movement in the education system for years, and so everybody's special, everybody gets a prize. It would seem like that maybe makes the understanding of humility maybe even harder to communicate, or maybe out of that is, how do we teach it to our kids? What are some ways that we can do that?
I think you're right with the self-esteem thing. That self-esteem movement, of course, started with good motives to try and repair the very low sense of self that some people express. And so, you know, what do? You try and build them up and so on. But then when these things become an entire movement, when they become dogmatic and society-wide, then you end up with the kind of madness that we find ourselves in, not just the U.S., certainly in Australia too. This idea that you can never criticize a child. Yeah, their school reports must always be, even the criticisms must be couched in compliments. And I think actually a lot of psychologists now realize what this is doing is creating a lack of resilience amongst our young ones, so that they can't take real criticism. They can't take real failure. And they need to be able to, because obviously the world isn't just one big self-affirming entity. You know, real life throws curveballs and brings blows that we need to learn to be able to deal with and learn from. If you're always trying to think of how good you are, even in the midst of a failure, what you're going to do is blame other people, blame circumstances, And 9 times out of 10, you'll learn absolutely nothing. Whereas if you take a more humble approach and say, hey, look, I probably really messed things up here, I need to analyze this, then you are likely to be better next time around. This is why criticism is actually so important. I've got a section on this in my book, that criticism really can be the leader's best friend, because in criticism you can learn in 5 minutes what might take you 6 months of self-reflection to learn about yourself. Even criticism that comes from a sort of bad motive from someone, you know, in the business or in the team or whatever, can still tell you loads about how you're coming across. None of us finds this easy. I don't find it easy, but I've learned over the years to stop whenever I hear a criticism and think, what is right about this criticism? And as a result, how can I be a better man tomorrow by responding to this criticism? And I've learnt in a kind of perverse way to enjoy criticism as an opportunity to be better tomorrow.
Which I guess brings up the question, is the lack of humility something that we should point out to others?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because their reply will be, well, what about you?
Yeah.
I think it's precarious to point out lack of humility in others. Although, if you've got good friends who know you well, then I think it's lovely to hear that kind of thing from friends. Some of the, you know, I would say some of my most fast-tracked improvements in character have come when really close friends have taken me aside and said, Dixon, I really think you need to work on this because you're coming across arrogantly or selfishly. And it's painful, but boy, it's a fast track to improvement.
And I suppose the reality is that most of us probably aren't really as self-aware about every aspect of our character that we should be.
No, we really aren't. Yeah. We're not a very self-aware, self-reflective society anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah. John Dixon is my guest today. We're talking about humility and how he achieved it. No, we're talking about humility and how we can all achieve it. I want to just maybe circle back for just a moment about some thoughts on how we maybe communicate this important virtue to our kids. I mean, we know that more is caught than taught, but are there some ways in which we can encourage it in our children?
Well, obviously, modeling it is the crucial thing. If they don't see it in us as parents, then there's no way they're going to value it, despite what you might teach. If they see something different in you, the lesson won't be learnt. So, it's got to start with you. But I guess I would emphasize again that it's not about being a mouse, not about being a pushover. It's about your children seeing in you someone who's fully confident in their own abilities and powers, but regularly chooses to use these for the sake of others. And when our little ones see this in us day in, day out, then I think we're in a good place to explain this to them. Now, obviously, I think teaching them the life of Jesus is also a powerful way for them to understand this, because if they understand that Jesus was the great Lord who chose to lower himself and give himself on a cross, if that is their sort of high mark of what a leader is, then that's really going to shape their decisions. So they're never going to think that them choosing to put others first, even if they feel they should be first, is a bad thing. Because if they've got the Jesus story in their heads, they will know it's an honorable and heroic thing to do what Jesus did. So focusing on the life of Jesus, I think, is crucial.
We're talking with John Dixon. We're going to talk a bit more about, getting some practical ways about how we can actually cultivate humility and some of the key aspects that it has in terms of leadership, because part of the reason for this book, Humilitas, Lost Key to Life, Love, and Leadership, and that's an important aspect of this book, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. John Dixon is a senior research fellow of the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University, and Sydney's co-director of the Center for Public Christianity, and a senior minister of St. Andrews in Roseville, and authored a dozen or more books, and we're happy to talk to John about humility on today's Connecting Faith, and there's more just ahead, Steve. You're listening to Connecting Faith and talking today with John Dixon. John specializes in the big ideas that have shaped our world and inspired men and women to live beyond themselves. And he spent some time, in fact, for a number of years, touring with an Australian rock band. Got a degree in theology and PhD in ancient history, and has gone on to write a number of books and produce documentaries, including A Spectator's Guide to World Religion and the Christ Files, How Historians Know What They Know About Jesus. And he's, among other things, co-director of the Center for Public Christianity. He's also a research fellow at the Department of Ancient History in Macquarie University. And the book we're referencing today is called Humilitas, A Lost Key to Life, Love, and Leadership. And we're looking at how humility has sort of shaped and changed our culture and this important virtue. And I guess I want to know, John, is this something that we can actually practice? And even by practicing it, does that, it will probably seem phony for a while, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said for just acting humble and seeing it influence your life. I know it sounds a little bit crass, but of course the psychologists tell us that there's an awful lot to be said for forming new habits of mind through new habits of behavior. And so the whole idea of cognitive behavioral therapy says that not only can new thoughts affect new behaviors, but new behaviors can affect new thoughts. And so just deciding to put humble acts into your daily routine can, over time, I think, recheck the thoughts. And in any case, you'll probably love it. So I just think of, say, the executive who's, let's just say, got a couple of hundred employees who normally just goes to work, heads straight up to his office, doesn't say hi to anyone, shuts the door and gets on with the busy, busy day, although he's probably at work before anyone's there anyway. But I would suggest that such a person just decides, three or four days a week to make sure they say hello and stop, pause, ask how people are, several people on the way up to the office or during a coffee break, and just choose to connect with those who would be surprised the chief executive is interested in their day. And just choosing to do that, I bet, will change thoughts about the importance of this, because the response from employees will no doubt be quite, powerful and inspire the leader to continue doing those sorts of things. I think the same with, say, a father who's got a teenage son, and the father is used to a more sort of heavy-handed approach. I think the father can just choose to take a more humble approach toward the child, even if it doesn't feel like you want to do this. I suspect forcing yourself to do it will create new habits of thought that will actually make you see the sense of this. So I'm with you. I really think acting humbly is one of the keys to actually pulling off humility.
I was thinking, even as you talked about, several instances, and say, people would be surprised. That's probably kind of an indictment, isn't it, on our society, that humility would be so surprising.
Yeah. Well, of course it is, because we all know ourselves, and we all know that it's so easy to get caught up in what you do. And when someone's at the top of the tree, whether they're, a top sports star or top executive or military commander, those who look up to them think, oh, well, you know, that's the sort of faraway land, that's someone who's so way above me that they don't have time for me. I think that is just a normal sort of human response to authority and power. But how wonderful to subvert that, because, of course, Jesus subverted this at every point, right? He went and sought out those who would never have thought he would be interested in them. And that humility on his part was the key to transforming so many lives and inspiring so many lives. And I just think the leader who puts this into practice will find a lovely response from those they choose to serve.
Will an increase in humility bring about higher levels of other virtues? I mean, is it sort of the mother of all virtues?
You could say so, in the same way that lots of people say that pride is the mother of all vices. The simple reason for this is that if you are really open to learning from others, learning about your mistakes, willing to take criticism, pausing always to think, how can I put the other first? That really is the place where you're going to learn all sorts of things about other virtues, about kindness, about love, about patience. These things will all flow from a more humble demeanor.
Are there sort of key indicators that we don't have enough humility, or is it simply just others confronting us at some point? Or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the hard thing about this topic. How do you know when you have humility? Because if you don't think you're humble, that's no indication that you are humble. It may just be that you are arrogant and you don't think you're humble because you're not humble. So it's a really difficult situation to try and ponder. I just think what's best is for every person to take stock occasionally and think through their life, think through their habits of the last week, and ask themselves the question, have I been using the talents and gifts and opportunities and powers that I have for others, or have I been just using these things for my own sake? And that little stock take, I think, will be very revealing. And if the answer is no, I haven't been doing this, well, then you just, I think you put these things into practice, and hopefully over time you'll cultivate humility. But I suspect you'll never really get to the point where you think, I have achieved humility. In case, if you do think you've arrived at that point, then you probably certainly haven't.
I guess if the title of the book was Humility and How I Achieved It, we'd know, I guess, that you probably, that wasn't quite accurate. The title of the book, though, is Humilitas, which is the Latin word for humility, right? So,
yeah, that's right.
Humilitas, a lost key to life, love, and leadership. And one thing that I remember catching my attention looking at the book, you had a couple of G.K. Chesterton quotes, but one of the things that Chesterton said, and I'd like you to respond to, is that it is impossible without humility to enjoy anything. What do you think that means?
Well, it's about realizing that you are small before the great things of the world. So that if you really think that you have it all in a self-contained way, you won't stop to be amazed by the things that are in front of you. If you're so self-absorbed, then the beauty in other people, the beauty in creation, the beauty of opportunities, a sense of thankfulness for what you have will all dissipate. Whereas if you have humility, then everything's a gift. You realize that the powers that you have, they've come from somewhere else. The powers that other people have are valuable. And you start to see the great things around you, not just in yourself. I think that's what Chesterton's getting at.
It's another quote from Chesterton. Of course, we had so many wonderful ones, but in the chapter you're talking about conviction and humility. And of course, Chesterton talked about, you know, we suffer today from, is what we suffer is humility in the wrong place. The modesty is moved from an organ of ambition and settled upon the organ of conviction. Of, you know, where we now, I think it's, you know, we're too mentally modest to believe in the multiplication table. So, I mean, so how do we maintain our convictions while still being humble?
Yeah, well, there's a whole section on this in the book, and I think it is one of the great issues our society needs to confront. Because on the one hand, we have this very high view of ourselves, and on the other, we have this very low view of truth. And Chesterton's point is, that's the reverse of what it really should be. We shouldn't have a high view of ourselves and a low view of truth. We should have a high view of truth and a low view of ourselves. But the humble person in possession of strong convictions isn't someone who modifies their convictions and says, oh, well, you know, my view isn't that important. My view isn't necessarily true. Your view is just as true as mine, which is how people often think about humility and conviction. They say, oh, if you think you've got the truth, you're being proud. Well, that makes no sense at all. The truly humble way to hold a conviction is to genuinely believe your conviction, even genuinely believe contrary convictions are false, but treat that person who holds a contrary conviction with grace and kindness, regarding them as important as yourself. So it's not about giving up your convictions. It's about treating people with contrary convictions with humility. So I would say a humble Christian is not someone who thinks that Islam is equally as true as Christianity. That would be to place humility on the wrong organ, as Chesterton puts it, to put it on the organ of conviction. The real way to approach the differences between Christians and Muslims is to say, look, I genuinely believe Christ is the Lord who entered the world and died on the cross and rose again. You think that's not true. You think he's just a prophet. I think that view is incorrect, but I treat you, my fellow human being, with all of the respect and friendship and kindness that I think you deserve as a human being made in the image of God. So humility is not a reason to hold your convictions less. It's a reason to regard those who hold contrary convictions highly, to treat them with respect and compassion. And I think we really need this. I think the world messes this up, but I also think the church messes this up. The world messes it up because it says you can't have a strong conviction about truth because there's no real truth. You all just have to agree everyone's got their own truth. That, to me, is profound weakness of mind, weakness of logic. We need to be able to hold our convictions. But the problem with the church sometimes is that we so strongly hold our convictions that we tend to mistreat those who hold contrary convictions, as if their contrary convictions are a reason for diminishing them as a human being. And when the church does that, of course, it's deeply worrying. It's quite contrary to the gospel, because of course Jesus had massive convictions, but he was able to treat those with contrary convictions. I'm thinking of the sinners and tax collectors with such grace and compassion, inviting them to the table for meals and so on. And so he was able to hold his convictions but show compassion at the same time. I long for the Christian church to be able to recover that genius of Jesus.
Are Christians the only ones who could truly be humble people?
I don't think so. It's certainly true that Christians have a more powerful motivator for humility. Because, of course, the average non-Christian isn't walking around with the idea that God, the Lord of the universe, entered the world in great humility and gave himself on a cross. So the average non-Christian doesn't think that's the center of reality, whereas a Christian does. So I would say the Christian has a more powerful motivation for humility, but I don't think I'd go so far as to say that the Christian is more expert at humility, is a more humble person, because there, you know, we're all wired differently, and there are plenty of atheists who, because of their personality or circumstances, have just fostered a kind of humble approach to life. I know atheists who are really humble people. Now, if I were to have a philosophical conversation with them and ask them what's the reason for their humility, then I think they would find it very difficult to ground the reason for humility in anything rational. Whereas a Christian can obviously ground their humility in something rational. We believe at the heart of the universe is a humble God. So I hope what I'm making clear is the inspiration for Christian humility is far greater than for non-Christian humility. But the actual day-to-day practice may not be all that different.
We're talking about humility and referencing the book Humilitas, A Lost Key to Life, Love, and Leadership. It was published by Zondervan and written by our guest today, John Dixon, who's a senior research fellow at the Department of Ancient History in Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. Co-directs the Center for Public Christianity and a senior minister at St. Andrews in Roseville. He's written a number of books, and we're going to talk more about humility, get some closing thoughts here in just a moment.
We put together our New Year's resolutions for 2014, but at Faith Radio, we want to know what you're praying for so that we can join you. Please visit myfaithradio.com and let us know what's on your heart and what you're praying for in 2014. Is it a job, your marriage, health? Let the power of prayer touch your life today in a fresh new way. And please know that the Faith Radio team will stand with you in prayer as we begin this new year. MyFaithRadio.com. Click on My Prayer for 2014. And thanks for letting us pray for you.
Organizations are looking for someone with the confidence and competence to lead and inspire positive change that not only impact those in the organization, but also the world.
Is that someone you?
With a Christ-centered master's degree in organizational leadership from Northwestern, it could be. Flexible online and blended learning formats are available. Check it out, unwsp.edu. University of Northwestern, St. Paul. Learn, lead, invest, impact.
You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we're happy to have connected today with John Dixon from Macquarie University. He's a senior research fellow at the Department of Ancient History there in Sydney, Australia, and co-directs the Center for Public Christianity. He's written a dozen or so books and done the film documentaries. The one that we're referencing is called Humilitas, A Lost Key to Life, Love, and Leadership. And we've talked a little bit about the leadership. I thought we'd just maybe mention a little bit more, because you talked about a persuasion, and we've sort of touched on it, but talk about a bit more about how humility and persuasion are linked, as are inspiration and aspiration.
Well, certainly persuasion is a key part of any leader's toolkit. I would rank it as one of the few really important tools for a leader. If a leader doesn't have powers of persuasion, then leadership would be very difficult, because, of course, leadership is about inspiring people to pursue a goal with all that they've got. So a leader needs to be a persuader. Doesn't necessarily mean they need to be super articulate, able to give great speeches, but it does mean that when they say, hey, don't you think we should head for this goal, people find themselves, you know, nodding their heads. So persuasion is crucial. Now, how does humility relate to persuasion? I think the simple rule of persuasion is that people believe those they trust. Now, that seems like the most simple statement you could ever make, but it's actually profound. People believe those they trust. And when a leader is known for being self-absorbed, having their own interests and their own bottom line in mind all the time, those that they lead won't believe their words, won't trust them, because every speech the leader gives, every direction the leader points to, the follower will think, hang on, I'm not sure if this is in our best interest. This is probably just for you. Now, turn that around and say, what about the leader who has all of the same skills and abilities as that first leader, but is known in the organization for putting others first, for even willing to sacrifice their own honor and bottom line to make sure the real goals of the organization are achieved, that employees are really well looked after. If that is the leader's reputation, when he or she opens their mouth to say, hey, don't you think we should head in this direction? Those that follow will say, yes, absolutely. Because the golden rule of persuasion is that the most persuasive person in the world is the one you know has your best interests at heart. And when you know your leader has your best interests at heart, you're willing to follow them. That's how humility and persuasion are intimately connected.
Which, of course, helps us to, I guess, aspire to do our best to be like them ourselves as well.
Right? Oh, absolutely, yes. The leader who is distant, aloof, you know, high achieving, sure, but never really connected with those that they lead, will be looked up to, of course, but they won't be emulated. You know, this the sort of the super great live in a different universe from the rest of us. But when the super great are actually humble, other person centered, give the time of day to every other employee in the organization, that's when that leader inspires people to be like them. Because for a moment, the employee or person in the organization thinks, hang on, this person who's achieved so much is just like me. They're so down to earth. Maybe that means I could be just like them. And I tell in the book of the time I met the rock band U2, who, you know, was my favorite rock band at the time, and you know, they lived in this sort of unapproachable glory of the world's greatest band. But I got to meet them years ago now, and discovered that they were so incredibly humble, interested in us, had questions of us. And I realized that day that these guys were not sort of demigods in a universe I could never attain. They were really down-to-earth people. And although I was I was a teenager or whatever, I left my meeting with U2 absolutely inspired to be a better musician. I was starting out in a band at the time, and the guys in the band thought, wow, they were sort of human like us. Maybe that means we could be just like them. Now, we never actually achieved any real fame or success, but we ended up going full-time within a couple of years. And I would say part of the reason we punched above our weight as a band was this encounter with our heroes, who seemed not aloof in an unapproachable universe, who actually seemed kind, gracious, other person-centered. And we thought we could be like them. Incredibly inspiring.
I was thinking there's, you know, just reflecting on that story now, many years later, that we could probably all recount a story or two of someone who exhibited interest in us, had that sort of noble approach, and made a lifelong impact in our lives.
Yes, yeah. I can even think of, you know, teachers from when I was, you know, like 10 or something, who were really interested in me and put me first. And I found them very, very inspiring. So all these years later, I can think of one particular teacher who I can't wait to tell that person, if I can ever track them down, that they had a real impact on me, even though they probably wouldn't have predicted it. And it was because of their humble attitude to me.
And is it as simple as maybe just asking a question, just showing interest in others? I mean, that's leading us on the road to humility?
I think it's one of the very real steps on the road to humility. I think if you just take the time to be interested in other people and learn from them, then you will see humility, I think, fostered. There are all sorts of things that we can do as well. I talk about the importance of thought experiments. That is, you may be going into a difficult meeting where you know there's going to be conflict, I would advise that you do a thought experiment in the hours leading up to the meeting where you think about every possible thing that could go wrong and every possible criticism thrown at you, and you practice a thought experiment of how you can respond graciously, how you can respond with humility, how you can not try and defend yourself but try and get the best outcome for the team. That sort of thought experiment and then going into a difficult meeting, I've found has helped me enormously deal with the actual meeting because you've already thought through how you can respond. So I think, you know, we've talked about just acting humbly. I would also think about thinking humbly as one way to improve your humility.
Book came out a couple of years ago, I guess now. Interested, has it it's percolated through your life a little bit and you get feedback and have opportunity to speak about it? Has it changed maybe one or two things in your life or how you respond to the world around you?
Yeah, I almost regret writing the book, to be honest. partly because, you know, I never realized that I would be the humility guy, which is hilarious to my best friends because they know the truth. So I'm almost embarrassed I wrote this thing, and you know, it comes back to bite me, and you know, friends and colleagues in my workplace remind me of certain things I've said in the book when I'm not practicing them. So it's quite terrible. But you know, I think one of the things that has really that writing the book has changed me on is this issue of criticism. I do write in the book about the importance of criticism, and I genuinely believed it when I wrote that. But I've since found that dealing with criticism, as painful as it is, can sometimes be the most rewarding of experiences. And you know, in my various roles, whether it's academic or in church or in the public square, criticisms can come thick and fast. And I suspect I've got better since the book came out at not defending myself instantly when I hear a criticism, but taking stock and wondering what might be true within the criticism. And, you know, maybe it's just me, but I find that this has been a great source of strength and development in my own life.
John Dixon, Senior Research Fellow at the Department of Ancient History at the Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, co-director of the Center for Public Christianity and Senior Minister of St. Andrews, Roseville, author of a dozen books or so, including Humilitas, A Lost Key to Life, Love, and Leadership from Zondervan. John, thank you so much for some time today. We've enjoyed the discussion.
Great to talk with you. I hope you can keep warm.